Welcome to Overthinking It, where we subject the popular culture to a level of scrutiny it probably doesn't deserve. This is the Ender's Game Book Club. This is episode one, week one, I should say, and it's chapters 1 through 6. I'm Matthew Rather, and with me is the world's foremost authority on Ender's Game, Ben Adams. Hey, Ben!
Hey, Matt. Good to be here.
How you doing? You know what we need? If you're the first and I'm the second, we need a third.
No thirds. we would lose all our benefits.
Right.
All our cush Overthinking It podcast benefits.
You should have read before you listen to this, chapters 1 through 6 of Ender's Game, and we're going to keep, all spoilers and anything about revealing anything about the plot confined to those 6 chapters. You can discuss, what we say, and you can discuss the discussion questions that have been posted, already. And there may be some topics already posted as well from readers in the forums on Overthinking It in the area of the forums that is for this week one span of chapters, numbers 1 through 6. So, Ben, should we just jump right in?
Let's do it. We'll start with chapter 1, 3rd.
Excellent. Well, what do you have to say about it, sir?
Well, I mean, of course, just from a plot perspective, for people that have read the book but haven't read it recently, this is obviously the first chapter. It takes us pretty much all the way through the fight with Stilson, the school bully. And the most interesting thing to me is that, at least in my copy, 7 pages into the book, the protagonist of our book is kicking a child on the ground. Like, it's described in the book as viciously in the ribs. Uh-huh. Which is an interesting way to start off to introduce a character.
Right. So we know a couple things at that point, though, right? I mean, the character introduction kind of begins by setting up a world around him, just in terms of we're going to surround him with enemies all the time. And then this thing about, like, he's in this, like, painful medical procedure where the monitor is being removed. And I guess the monitor, it's not gone into all that much, but I guess the monitor is how they determine whether he's a good candidate for battle school, right?
Right. Yeah. They don't, it's not really mentioned again, but yeah, presumably it's how they screen, if not all candidates, then at least their most promising candidates. I think it's mentioned in the second chapter that Peter had his until he was 5, and Valentine had hers until she was like 3 or 4. So that the previous Wiggins also had monitors at one point.
Yeah. Okay. So he's getting picked on because he's a third. Though we learn, do we learn in these chapters that the Wiggins were given special dispensation, right?
Right. I think that's a little bit in one and then a lot in the second chapter that they talk about that it's okay that he's a third, at least to the government, but there's still this social stigma attached to being a third.
Yeah. So, okay. So he's viciously kicking a child in the ribs, and this is sort of his first action, but there's a lot of, build up to it kind of mentally for him, like in that this is going to, right, this is going to be like the schoolyard fight to end all schoolyard fights, you know?
Right. That he's willing to be violent because he wants to end it. He doesn't want to keep getting picked on. And he knows that in the long term, he loses. You know, if they keep ganging up on him, he can't win every fight. So he's just got to win this one.
Right. Well, sure. And that, like, for him, the violence is not, you get the sense with Peter, you know, especially when they start playing astronauts and buggers, that the violence is an end in itself. You know, it's the process of violence for Peter is a source of pleasure, right? A source of enjoyment. He has a sort of sadistic streak. And with Ender already, even, there's a kind of, not to say weariness, but there's a kind of utilitarian calculation that goes on for him, right? That, like, all these outcomes are bad. What is the least bad outcome that's possible?
Right. There's a good line that describes exactly that. This would not have a happy ending. So Ender decided that he'd rather not be the unhappiest at the end. sure. that he's going for the least bad option.
Yeah.
Which involves him being violent. But you get the sense that if he had another way, or at least if he saw another way out, he would take it.
He was trying to figure out a way to forestall vengeance, to keep them from taking him in a pack tomorrow. I have to win now. I have to win this now and for all time, or I'll fight it every day. And it will get worse and worse and worse. And I mean, that's sort of funny. That's like, you hear a lot. There have been a lot throughout history of political speeches justifying wars or justifying committing our country or other countries throughout history to war by if we don't do this now, if we don't sort of stand now, we're going to suffer for our inaction now for all time. So it's like it's already he's kind of internalized this rhetoric of I don't know, violence as the regrettable but sort of only available tool for solving certain kinds of problems.
Which is, of course, writ large, how the human race sees the war against the buggers. That
right.
They've attacked us, and the only way out is violence. That is the only way we have to deal with this particular problem.
Yeah, well, and with the buggers, it's interesting because they're not available to diplomacy, right? Because we don't know how to communicate with them because they're bugs, right? They're buggers.
Right, and I can't remember how much they get into these first few chapters, but I think it's discussed that there's no way we tried and it just didn't work the first two times that we fought the buggers. That there was just war and there was nothing else going on.
Yeah, it's not like there were demands or anything like this. At least insofar as I could suss out the backstory, they just attacked, right, and just started killing people.
Correct. Yeah. And I think that I can't remember where I read it, but I read something somewhere which is talking about, the limits of nonviolence is when your enemy has limits. Like your enemy has to have a certain thing that he's not willing to do to you for nonviolence to work. And to the extent that that's true is arguable, but that's kind of the philosophy at work here, that if they're just going to kill you no matter what you do, the only option is to fight back.
Well, I suppose it depends what your... it depends what the payoffs are, right? Like the only way for nonviolence to work is if your enemy has limits, assumes a certain definition of work, right?
values of work.
Yeah, right, exactly. That is to say, not getting killed, right? Because losing, dying is always an option,
True.
Right. Though, interestingly, philosophically, it isn't an option. At least it's kind of given short shrift here, right? The option of laying down, because, it's something that Graf says to Ender, I think in chapter six, we're evolutionarily programmed to survive, as evidenced by the fact that we have survived, right?
Right. Like I think he says individuals have an option to not survive, to sacrifice their lives, to accept death in exchange for some other victory. But as a species, we don't have that option. We can't make that choice. We're simply not programmed to make the choice as a species to lose.
And that's interesting. So it's so that there sort of sets the table conceptually, right? Like as to what definitions of work, metaphor to its breaking point, but what definitions of work are allowable? I mean, it sets the scope conditions for the kind of world we are inhabiting here, philosophically, anyway, but I'm sort of getting ahead of myself. And this collectivist idea that like the species can't choose. I mean, how does the species choose? It doesn't. It just sort of reacts, right? And the in aggregate, the species reaction is going to be life affirming, right?
And of course, Graf's argument there is kind of a canard, because what he's really saying is that the individuals within the species will choose to live. And those individuals, because they live, are going to be the ones that generally make the decisions. The individuals that are okay with dying will probably die, and they will not be in a position to make all the decisions for the species. It's hard to imagine a pacifist running the international fleet.
Yeah. So why this fight now? I think that I think it's because he's newly vulnerable, right? Like why today, like, is a big question of any story. And it's that his monitor is out. So he's no longer sort of protected. He's no longer protected by the government. Right.
Right.
And like, so in another podcast we do, in the TFT podcast that we do on Overthinking It, Ryan Sheely is fond of pointing out a particular definition of the state. And I think it's Weber. I am not a political scientist, so, you know, forgive me for any inaccuracies. But the definition of a state as a state is a monopoly on the use of violence, on the legitimate use of violence. That is to say, a police force, say, right? Like, can use violence in a coercive way, sort of to keep the peace among people. And it strikes me that in situations of armed conflict where there is no recognized, or there is no legitimate, or there is no effective kind of higher authority to appeal to, right? There's no sort of judicial process, you know. It's an interesting question as to what counts as legitimacy, right? For the use of violence without, if you don't have recourse to a coercive third party, or a third party that has coercion available to them, right? Like a state, you know, I don't know, in order to keep your neighbor from playing loud music, or, you know, I don't know, to keep people from stealing things from you on the street, right? Like, where does your legitimacy come from then? I had a friend in grad school who used to say, you know, your right to swing your fist ends at my face. Getting a little John Stuart Mill there. I don't know. What do you think?
This is actually something that comes up a lot in international lawyers talk about this question all the time, because in international relations, that's exactly what you're talking about. When country A has a dispute with country B, the only neutral party, the only third parties are countries C through Z. There are world courts and there are bodies like the UN, but they don't function in the same way that a government does. They don't have the monopoly on the use of legitimate force. Everybody has kind of an equal right or obligations with respect to force.
Yeah, it's funny. It's almost like there kind of is an international legislature, and there kind of is an international judiciary, but there's no international executive, right?
Right.
Because it sort of wouldn't work.
Right. When nobody's willing to do it, nobody's willing to submit to an international executive,
right,
or, you know, produce an international executive. And so
a lot of them aren't even willing to submit to the international judiciary,
right?
And I include us in that.
Yeah. But of course, the other thing is there's lots of international judiciaries.
Fair enough. There are
commercial courts that pretty much everybody agrees to, because you've got to get the bills paid. You know, everybody wants their goods to flow. But then of course, when you get into issues like war crimes tribunals and issues like that, then people are less willing to submit to world authority. And so there's a debate where some people would say that international law without an executive is really just politics. It's really just the who's strongest in a particular dispute, and they're going to win every time. But then there are some people who are like, no, there really is law. It's just horizontally enforced as opposed to vertically enforced.
Sure. Yeah, because you still have to live here, right? Like, you can't you can't do something just terrible as a nation and expect nation C through Z to continue to deal with you. I mean, unless you have a lot of oil. But I digress.
Yeah, and of course, Ender's Game, the world building we have here, is kind of a question of, well, what would it take to get everybody in line behind one, not quite world government, but certainly one world body, the international fleet here, and it's an external threat. That's the only thing that brings people together is a bigger problem.
Well, okay, maybe chapter two, I guess. We move on to, it's funny. It opens up a lot of areas. I feel like we could go forever into each of these, but we should soldier on.
So what stood out to you in chapter two?
Well, I liked a couple of the things. Like, I wonder if the buggers, I think the idea of like putting on the bugger mask is a very interesting symbol. And it's not that it's all that complex a symbol, but it's, it gets at this idea of sort of empathy and being able to see from your opponent's point of view, and being able to sort of empathize, being able to sort of become your opponent in some sense, right? Like putting on the mask. And when he says, like, I wonder if the buggers wear human masks, right? I wonder if they play games like that. This is sort of interesting. But then a few things like, they don't wear this face like a mask. It is their face is one of the things that Ender thinks about it. So this whole thing, I mean, it sort of introduces the sadism of Peter, and it's a sort of like we're in sort of worst fear territory with Ender at the end of chapter one, when he says, I take away the monitor and I'm just like Peter. But of course, I mean, of course he's not. He didn't start the fight, but he will finish it, right?
Right.
And you get the sense that Peter looks for a pretext for this kind of violence, right? Like for this kind of fighting, and the pretext of the game, right? Like the idea of game, of what is a game. It is the first thing that is one of the things that's introduced here, where he, Valentine says, he's really being a jerk. He's like, choking Ender out or something like that. And it's, now he's going to tell us it was all a joke, says Valentine. And Peter replies, not a joke, a game. I can make you guys believe anything. So this, right, this is sort of an interesting definition of game. In fact, Peter is referring to like a game that is ulterior to the game that he is purporting to play, which is like cops and robbers or astronauts and buggers, whatever it is. But in fact, he's saying, no, the game that I'm playing ulterior to that is that I can put thoughts in your head, right? I can make you believe anything. I can make you think what I want you to think and behave in the way that I want you to behave. Not exactly through persuasion, but through persuasion of a sort, I guess. This is sort of interesting, right? Like, A, what is a game? B, what game is being played at any given moment, and see, is there another game, right? Is there a game ulterior to the game being played that's going on at the same time that you just don't see?
And I think we see that at the end. We kind of see three versions of Peter throughout this chapter. There's the sadistic Peter who's telling Ender he's going to kill him, and, you know, that the this chilling speech about how, you know, I'm going to... someday I'm going to kill him, but you're going to think it's an accident because you'll have forgotten all about this or something like that. And then he switches kind of without any, easily changes gears to, oh, ho, ha, ha, it's all a joke. And then at the end, we have him crying and apologizing to Ender. And it's unclear which, if any of those, is Peter's mask. Which of those is a game for him and which of those is really who he is?
Hmm.
And I don't think we ever get a really solid answer on that, certainly not in this chapter. But of course, the sadistic Peter is the one that really sticks with Ender for a long time.
Yeah.
But I like that's an interesting the idea of levels of games, and it's something we see, you know, throughout the book about there's games with rules and there's games without rules and there's games within games, and knowing the rules to one might actually hurt you if you're paying attention to the larger game.
I mean, right. Like, what are the characteristics of a game? We may as well just try to puzzle right. that out now, right? Like, I think it's important that a game has rules, right? That is to say, right. there are kind of defined. There's a defined range of sort of moves that, you know, the acceptable moves and, you know, right. And that I think that also it has no, the game is independent of the world outside, right? That the game doesn't have, it's not that it doesn't have a bearing on the world outside. You can, you know, bet at cards, right? and sometimes the betting is part of the game in games that are played in rounds or turns. But that the game proceeds without recourse to the, you know, to the world outside. That is to say, the rules of blackjack don't suddenly change if we at 6 o'clock p.m. versus 6 o'clock a.m. Right, the rules of blackjack are always the rules of blackjack. So there's some. I was about to say something like, the rules of blackjack don't change if we like go to war, with a country. But then I thought that was in poor taste. So I won't say that. I won't even think it. That is to say the game is separate. It's kind of free. It's freestanding and it's abstract, and is not dependent on external circumstances.
Right. And to the extent that they are dependent on external circumstances, those external circumstances become internal to the game.
Right.
Like you could have a casino that changes the rules of blackjack at 6 p.m., but then it would be blackjack, you know, Knights or something, you know, whatever brand name.
Then it would be an awesome casino. Blackjack after dark.
That would just be part of the strategy, and the card counters would figure out, well, how does my strategy change at 5:58 when the rules are about to change? You know, am I more likely to, you know, how long is it going to take to finish this round? And, you know, it would just be integrated into the game, and the definition of what's external shifts, but it's still internal to the game. There has to be some limits. Your game can't just be the real world.
Right. In order for your game to work, right?
Right. There have to be limits. Otherwise, you're just playing life.
Yeah, exactly. So this idea of like internal to the game and external to the game is, you know, I don't know, is something that's kind of raised. Is something that's sort of raised here. I mean, like, right, like when Peter comes to Ender and seems remorseful or at least seems sympathetic, I think when he says, I know how it feels, I think he's talking about losing the monitor and with it, you know, the chance to go do great things at battle school, to be one of the select few children who can go to battle school. I think he's not talking about being on the receiving end of his own sadism. I think that he's talking about being sort of passed over by the grownups or being sort of tossed aside. Whereas once, you know, everyone was convinced and he was convinced he was special. I think that's the basis for the sympathy, not necessarily that it's, Not necessarily that it's that he's has all this sort of insight into his own behavior at this point.
That seems right.
Yeah,
and I think I'll add one more kind of definitional thing to our definition of game here, which is that you have, and I'm choosing this word relatively carefully, participants in the game.
Sure.
And you have non-participants, and that participate implies a level of autonomy and choice, is that you chose to be involved in the game.
Right.
But of course, that's when it becomes interesting, because that's not always the case. Sometimes people get involved. Sometimes people get pulled into someone else's game without that choice.
Sure. But it's, I mean, we would recognize that, like, it's not fair. You know, I don't know, if I bust at blackjack, right, the house can't reach into the pocket of the guy standing behind me who's just observing and take his money, right? Like, he didn't he didn't agree to play blackjack after dark.
Right. And if in football it's totally okay to, you know, run at somebody as hard as you can and tackle them, but you can't do it to the guy who's standing on the sidelines, you know, getting a slushie.
Yeah.
He didn't agree to participate in the game.
Right. There's, I mean, I'm put in mind of a great scene in Varsity Blues, starring the one and only James Vanderbeek, where in order to stop the clock, he throws the football at the opposing team's mascot. And it becomes a running gag in the movie that he just, you know, he just beans the mascot, whoever it is. So I guess, right, like there are participants, there are non-participants, and then there are mascots who can be. Yeah, okay, so I guess on to chapter 3, Graf. This begins, like, this is interesting. The sister is the weak link. He really loves her. And this is, you know, referring to Valentine. Well, I've said Valentine, but you've said Valentine. Do we know, is there a canonical source for the pronunciation?
I suspect there is, but I couldn't tell you.
Yeah, you know what? I'm going to adopt your pronunciation, since you, sir, are the world's greatest foremost authority.
We'll go with that.
On this book. So in comes Graf, right? And we learn that all the stuff with taking the monitor out and the fight, this has all been a game, right? Or this has all been, I guess, a final test. And I mean, it's interesting, like school is maybe a special case of game, or sort of, test, right? Test is a special case of game, right? Because it's delineated in time, right? It is distinct from the outside world. There is this same sort of informed consent problem. Like, you don't know necessarily when you're being tested in the way that you're supposed to know when you're taking a game. And though it has a bearing on the outside world, it sort of is distinct from the outside world. And there's a sort of structure of accepted moves and payoffs within the confines of a test. And when we learned that, like, this is, what would you do with the with the monitor off, right? That this had been a test. This is, again, like, sort of kind of like Peter Graf has been playing a game, or has been sort of executing a strategy ulterior to the purported strategy.
Right. And that the norm that you get to know when you're participating in a game is on display here, because Ender and his parents are upset that Graf kind of changed the rules, that as far as they knew, the monitor was to decide whether Ender was going to make it or not. And then Graf changed the rules and said, no, it's actually taking the monitor out as part of the test, but we're just not going to tell you about that part of the test.
And you don't get a sense that it's a part of the test for all the kids, right? Like, this is, you know, long ago, a prophecy was foretold that there would be an Ender who comes around to end things, I guess. So the conversation that Graffin has with Ender about religion, right? Like, about, I mean, and it's sort of calculated to sever his affectionate ties with his parents, right? Like, right. They don't really want you. They're just a crazy Polish Catholic and a crazy Mormon, you know? So, they're all into the lots of kids, right? And what's that? I love the word, the euphemism that gets tossed around here, which is non-compliant,
right?
Maybe,
yeah. Which I think they're talking about they're like compliant with the post-Bugger War regulations that this future society, in response to the need to fight the buggers, has changed all these rules around, like having the third child and presumably supporting the international fleet and whatever else they've done. That you're non-compliant, which seems to be a bit of an insult here. That you're not complying with what everybody's doing. Everybody's pitching in to win this war for humanity, and if you're non-compliant, then you're not pitching in. You're not pulling your weight.
Right. So the idea that the idea that he puts in Ender's head is that he didn't. My parents didn't want me. You know.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
there's you highlighted the same thing in the front that I liked, which is this this interesting comparison of love to weakness. That
sure.
His love for the sister is a weakness, and is an interesting. It later in that dialogue, there's a dichotomy I like, which is that Plan A is lying to Ender, and Plan B is the truth,
uh-huh.
which is the opposite of what normally it is. Normally, you muddle on as best you can with the truth, and then you lie in. Only in the circumstance where you don't think the truth will work. But, of course, the graph goes the other way around. The lie is preferable. And in the worst-case scenario, we'll go with the truth.
Huh. Yeah, that's the must be the difference. You see, you're married and I'm not, so you've learned that the truth is the best policy at all times.
But sometimes lies, what's the line? Lies tell more truth than the truth.
Yeah. So I mean, this is a pretty interesting thing that that Graf says that like they're both proud of you and also ashamed of you, Ender, because you're a third. They're ashamed of coming from non-complying families. And I love the little aside that's like, well, people do strange things for religion, right? You get the sense that we're in a post-religious. A post-religious world, right? In Ender's Game, that it's there, but it's not really a force, and it's certainly not a force in public life, the way it is. You know, I don't know, in our contemporary United States, for example.
Right, and at the very least, Graf wants to make Ender, who is six, so doesn't have a whole lot of world experience. Graf is a powerful person to Ender, who's this. You know, he's the international fleet.
Yeah.
And so Graf's opinion of religion is going to be formative for Ender, who may not have made up his mind yet. And so Graf doesn't want his prize pupil influenced by this potentially unpredictable, I shouldn't say weird, but unpredictable influence of religion. If Ender gets religion, who knows what they're going to be able to do with him?
That's interesting.
So they need to make sure he's not religious, because that, you know, is going to change. It makes him more predictable.
Well, all that pesky turn the other cheek and love your neighbor and
right.
And that stuff. I mean, we can't be having that in the battle room.
Right. Although it's interesting because there's a little bit of manipulation where Graf has kind of zeroed in on how Ender sees the world and says to convince him to come. But if there's a chance that because you're with the fleet, mankind might survive and the buggers might leave us alone forever, that I'm going to ask you to do it.
Mm-hmm.
That's kind of a strange. That's not really what's going on with this war. Is that, well, we're just going to try to get them to leave us alone. We don't think we can communicate with them, and so getting them to leave us alone is a form of communication. This is an all hands war. This is a war, presumably to the end. But Graf doesn't put it like that. Graf isn't telling Ender that you're going to have to fight and fight and fight until one side is dead. No, he doesn't. Well, maybe we'll get him to go away, because that's kind of what Ender would prefer. Ender just wants to fight until he can go home.
Right. Yeah. I wonder how much we choose. I mean, it's interesting when you say Ender hasn't had a chance to make up his mind yet about religion. Not to get too personal, but I was raised Catholic, and I feel like what my life has borne out the idea that whatever I choose to practice, those ideas are always in there. It's like a first language. You know what I mean? It's like a worldview that sort of always travels with me, wherever I go. And I think that especially talking about a 6-year-old, the idea of like, well, is he capable of consent? I mean, is he capable of informed consent? And this, you know, this gets at the idea that someone brought up in the comments, fizzled in the comments on our Prolegomenon podcast. The idea of sort of prodigious children, right? Like child prodigies and giftedness in children. And you know, it's sort of an interesting question, right? Like does a 6-year-old preternaturally gifted gymnast, you know, does that person really have the opportunity to consent or not to hours and hours of practice, you know, for 10 years to try to become an Olympian, right? Like, or a ballet dancer or a, you know, any of the number of things, you know, because at a certain point, the stuff you're told as a child just becomes the stuff that you believe, just becomes the background of your worldview, and you can't, regardless of your sort of actions, you can't sort of alter the internal landscape, right? Like after a certain point,
right? And I think you had it right on the nose when you said it's like a language. There's a lot of interesting research about the extent to which language shapes thought.
Sure.
And you can argue back, people argue back and forth about this, you know, all the time, but, you know, there's the idea that, you know, if you had a culture that has different words for like different parts of the spectrum, would they see colors differently if they have different words to kind of group colors together? And, you know, of course people argue back and forth about this, but I think it's true to the extent that once you've learned this stuff at a very young age, it never really goes away. And of course, we see that throughout the book, particularly Ender's relationships with his Peter and Valentine in particular. His relationships with them shape his worldview and shape the way he deals with problems.
Mm-hmm.
That he's always asking himself, kind of, what would Peter do? What would Valentine do? And then he kind of decides for himself, well, what would Ender do?
WWED.
Right. He would probably violently destroy whatever the problem is.
Yeah, sure. I guess that it's a very active area of research, right? Like the relationship between language and thought, especially now that I am not a linguist, but I'm given to understand that the stranglehold of like Chomsky and generative linguistics has been broken somewhat recently, and that other ideas are sort of ascendant in the, you know, I don't know, in the profession. I don't know if there are any linguists listening, let us know in the comments or rather in the forums. I think we're going to close the comments on this and use the forums exclusively for this. So let's talk about linguistics and sort of language and thought, and like the extent to which, you know, the extent to which religious belief is a kind of language or a kind of existential language, a kind of way of being in the world, or I don't know, assumptions about, assumptions about fairness in the world, right? Are another kind of thing that you grow up with, whether the world is fair or not. I mean, whether you grow up thinking it is or it isn't, you know, a lot of the time those beliefs can persist, really stubbornly, I don't know, ideas of sort of patriotism and nationalism and, you know, I don't know, the meaning of certain public institutions, right? Like, I grew up being told that, for example, again, God, I'm getting so political, but how can you not with this with this material?
Right.
Police were helpful, right? Like, and that I that as a kid, if you're ever separated from your parents, you know, find a policeman. It's not like there were so many wandering around, right? Like in the, in the neighborhood I grew up with, that you could just like go to the corner and find one. if you could, I'm not even sure that would be a desirable thing. But like that, and yet I can imagine, you know, someone growing up, you know, not 10 miles from me in a very different part of LA, where the cops are viewed as a threat, right? As essentially sort of untrustworthy, and as disruptive to the community rather than being protective of it. And I wonder these sorts of very core assumptions about the meanings of things in the world, right? Like whether they're religious, whether they're political, whether they have to do with the nature of relationships with other people or the nature of sort of fairness or the nature of the kind of the organization of the world. Whether you really are ever able to choose them. I'm saying that you know, I think you're kind of not. I think you sort of get what you get, contingent on the circumstances circumstances that you come up with, you come up in. And this is a long, long way around the barn to address something you brought up about sort of Ender, choosing what he believes, right? Like, or being able to, having the capacity to choose what he believes. And for what it's worth, I think that Ender's Game, the novel, is with me, right? Because we've seen already in these first six chapters, the idea that like we have to condition him, you know,
right.
We have to like surround him with the precise environment we need to get the responses out, to get the results out that we need.
Right. And the whole language shaping thought, I mean, it's right there up front with the concept of third. If you called somebody a third today in 21st century America, they just kind of look at you funny and wonder what you were talking about and why that was, why you said it with a sneer in your voice that they're a third child. It's not a problem. But in the world of Ender's Game, where it's become a political and social more, it's an insult that 6-year-olds know, that the children taunting Ender call them, you know, they lost your birdie 30. There, it's as bad as being a stupid head or whatever, yeah. You know, whatever else 6-year-olds do. And that, so this word now has power that didn't previously have power. And it's all just based on your assumptions about what is and is not acceptable behavior.
I don't know, before we get to an hour, which seems like a reasonable time to wrap up, I guess we should,
keep pushing on here.
Yeah, I guess we should push on through the book. So Launch, chapter 4, we get on, onto the shuttle headed, to battle school.
Right. And there's a great little bit in here that I like where, Ender's being yelled at on the shuttle by Graf. And and Ender kind of uses what he's seen about the military on TV and uses that as kind of his reference point for looking at what's happening. And then, of course, it gets kind of turned around by Graf. It's not what Ender's expecting. And I think that's at least the book trying to set us up for that this book as a whole is going to be, to some extent, a deconstruction of the traditional military tropes, that this isn't going to be what Ender expects, where all of a sudden he becomes friends with Graf because they had this bonding experience. Like, no, that's not what's happening here. Graf is shaping him into a weapon, into a tool that they can then do what they need to do with, which isn't really the story that's being told in the traditional military training story, where it's like, we're all getting through this together to accomplish this goal. And so I think we're getting set up for that right at the beginning.
I heard something a while ago that may or may not be true. Maybe you have more insight into it than I do. That the actual U.S. Army was that people who actually trained soldiers were really upset with the slogan "an army of one," right? Which was cooked up by a PR firm or something like that, by an advertising agency, right? Because the idea of like the cohesiveness of a unit, of like being able to function in small teams and being able to actually surrender a lot of your individuality in favor of playing a part, right, in a team effort at accomplishing an objective, right, is so integral to that kind of military training. And that, like, I don't know, being an army of what, like trying to be a hero is just the worst thing, right? And sort of that sort of me against the world mentality, like, is the worst thing for someone you're trying to sort of inculcate a sense of duty and of mission and of, you know, I don't know, something like that in.
I can't speak for, you know, army drill sergeants, but I certainly know a lot of people that were not big fans of of that statement, and for a couple of reasons. I think one is that it kind of conjures up the idea that you join the army for you,
right?
That you're joining the army so that you can get an education, so that you can get training to go get a better job or whatever, which is not sure. Those are what you're doing to recruit people, and that those are all important things. But the soldiers you want are soldiers that are there for something more than just a paycheck at the end of the day.
Sure.
And there's a great, these are very controversial. We're getting dangerously close to politics here because Victor Davis Hanson is a very controversial historian. But he has a book called Carnage and Culture, where he talks about various cultures and their military backgrounds. And some of his conclusions are way overly broad about culture. But one of the most accurate things he says in the book, which is that one of the cores of Western military thought is the idea of you do your job by staying in line and you get medals by protecting the guy next to you. You don't get medals for killing a lot of the enemy.
Right.
And that's kind of contrasted with like the image of the berserker, that the single person who runs into the line and kills 10 of the enemy, he gets all the honor at the end of the day.
Right.
In the U.S. Army, you're the jackass that ran into the enemy and almost got everybody killed.
Right, of course.
If you do that. And, of course, the Victor Davis Hanson, and you can question all this, he argues that it goes all the way back to the phalanx, where literally your only job was staying in line. You had your shield, and it was literally locked into the shield next to you. And if one person broke, everybody broke. And so that inculcated this idea of, you're not an army of one. You are an army of an army.
Yeah.
You have to work as a team.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I mean, it's funny. There is no sense in this chapter of joining the military as being like instrumentally beneficial to you, right? There's no like GI Bill for battle school.
No.
You know, there's,
I mean,
no...
in fact, in the chapter before, Graf explicitly says, like, if this were up to making the best and happiest future for you, you shouldn't come with me. Like, you should stay at home.
Yeah. That, you know, and you can sort of wonder how much a 6-year-old really can possibly understand that idea of sacrifice, you know.
Right.
But there's none. I mean, there's none of that. There's like the buggers are out there, right?
Yeah.
And that like it's my job to be a tool. What does he say? Okay, here's the passage I highlighted. Human beings are free except when humanity needs them. Maybe humanity needs you to do something. Maybe humanity needs me to find out what you're good for. We might both do despicable things, Ender, but if humankind survives, then we were good tools. And Ender says, is that all just tools? And Graf answers, individual human beings are all tools that the others use to help us all survive. Says, that's a lie. And Graf replies, no, it's just a half truth. You can worry about the other half after we win this war. So the idea, I mean, it's interesting. I mean, it's interesting how absent, and I think that like, I think that it's conspicuously absent, right? Like, I think it's glaringly absent. The absence of any sort of instrumental benefit, not just that the international fleet is going to pay for college, but the idea that there might be, you know, I don't know, there might be even the sense of like we will grow in you a sense of strength of character. You know right. what I mean? Like
you'll beat the buggers and you'll always know that you beat the buggers. You'll always have that with you.
Yeah, of course. Or you'll stand taller or you'll right. understand something about honor or that, you know what I mean? That there is, that you'll get privileged access to a kind of higher truth, you know, fighting alongside your comrades. No, none of that. I mean, none of that, not even the most crass, not just the most crass financial ones, but also any of the larger sort of spiritual ones, justifications for, I mean, or sort of enticements, I guess, to sort of volunteer for military service. It's all just, there is an end. It's necessary that the end be accomplished, and you have to do it because you can.
Right. And it's interesting. And, in the end of this chapter, there's a little bit of, one of the teachers asks Graf, is that the one? And Graf responds, God knows. And, you know, to the extent that Ender's Game is a story about the prophesied one, it kind of turns that on its head because it makes pretty clear that Ender is the one only because he's been chosen by Graf to be shaped into the one.
Uh-huh.
That Graf is moving heaven and earth to make Ender into a tool that can be used by humanity. But there's not, while Ender maybe is the best candidate, it's not, if Ender drops dead on page 37, presumably the war goes on, and there's maybe somebody else that can do it. That will now have to be the product of all of Graf's shaping. But in the meantime, he's the one because he's the one that's been picked.
Yep. So when he gets two battle school, he gets the low bunk by the door. they meet Dap. They meet Dap, and he discovers the game room where he can, am I missing something? He discovers the game room. So, we learn a little bit about school, right? Like, hours of classes, reading, numbers, history. Numbers, I think, means math, right?
Right.
Videos of the bloody battles in space. It's interesting. Like, so propaganda, right, is part of...
Would you like to know more?
Ender's Roughnecks.
Right.
there are only two rules. Everyone crouches down and... Oh, no, sorry. Spoiler alert. So the idea, there's some interesting stuff when he starts playing in the thing, and like turns out, well, you know, he's the chosen one, so he can play video games better than anyone else. All he had to do was watch the game and understand how things worked, and then he could use the system. He could use the system and even excel. It was the waiting and watching that cost the most for during that time he had to endure. So this sort of plays into his assumption, and I think our assumption, of a game as having sort of stable rules, right?
Right.
And
he's good at either exploiting the rules as they're written or finding unwritten rules that the other people aren't thinking of.
Yep.
And we see this on display because one thing we kind of alighted over was this conflict he has with Bernard.
Oh, right.
The other children. And Ender kind of waits for his moment and uses the desk because that's somewhere where he... And that's kind of a part of the battlefield that Bernard wasn't paying attention to.
Sure.
This kind of propaganda war. And so Ender is able to use that as a weapon. As a way of exploiting what the battlefield between the two is, in order to gain an advantage.
Mm. Yeah. And of course, messages from God about,
right.
You know, And yeah, and it's very, and I mean, it's funny. It's extremely, it's typical little boy stuff. It's, you know, butts and it's all kinds of, you know, who's a doo-doo head. And, and yet it gains this kind of extremely sinister, tone, you know what I mean? You really feel like, stuff could go down, you know,
right.
trouble could start.
And I think this is one of the things I talked about in our prologue episode was that this is a young adult book that doesn't look down on children. And I think this is where we see it, which is problems. Little children fighting in the schoolyard looks like little children fighting in the schoolyard to adults. It looks like this kind of silly problem that, you know, haha, you can laugh and reminisce about. But to the children fighting, it's a serious problem. This is an Armageddon fight. This is the battle for all the marbles is who's going to win the playground fight.
Right.
Because their problems are serious to them. And that's, I think, well captured in the book here. And of course it's amped up for the reader because we know that
the fate of humanity is at stake.
Right. That there are consequences about who wins these battles because it means who's going to be the officers down the road that are going to fight the battle that beats the buggers.
Right. It's interesting. We talked about like a games in that they have like delineation. They have a domain. There's a demarcation of what is within the game and what is outside the game. And you know, if your game is the schoolyard, or if your world ends at the schoolyard, rather, whoever's in charge of the schoolyard is the most powerful person in the world.
Right.
Right. And so this is, I think it's a real success of the narrative that in drawing us into this world where it feels like, you know, it feels like it's being fought for mortal stakes, right? The battle of who's a doo-doo head. And who isn't.
Yeah, right. That Ender making friends with Shen is, you know, the equivalent of Grant securing Little Round Top at Gettysburg. That, like, this is, you know, a significant tactical victory that has been won here.
So I'm, I actually want to, if it's okay with you, tell me, we can kind of skip some of this stuff about the relationships with other kids.
Right.
And like he gets oriented and you learn that some of the kids have sort of, aptitude for zero gravity, and Ender gets good at it by sort of figuring it out. But I think that a lot of this zero G stuff is gonna come up more in later installments. So maybe we can just skip ahead to the giant's drink and to the game that he plays on his desk. And by the way, I mean, has anyone pointed out that these are iPads? right, 20 years before there were. Before there were iPads, or 25 years rather, like it's pretty astonishing the way it's envisioned sort of works very well here.
Ender's Game doesn't get, I think, enough credit for being pretty prescient about a lot of the way, because of course it was written in the 80s, so you know personal computers were just coming around, but prescient about the way that we would use them. That the way would kind of humans would interact with them.
Sure, he got iPads right, and he got Reddit right.
Right, yeah, he got blogging right.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, not to get
ahead of ourselves.
Yeah, but the whole Valentin Peters subplot involves them on the internet and influencing, and that there's some great stuff in there about which is pretty, you know, pretty just understanding human nature and how we'd want to interact with technology.
Yeah. But so this game that he plays is not, I mean, doesn't seem to be, I don't know, it's a little allegory of the soul rather than being martial in nature, right? Like, so,
right.
But it's interesting because you die in this game, right? And like, early on in the section when he's talking about the game that ends at the giant's drink, he had lots of deaths, but that was okay. Games were like that. You died a lot until you got you got the hang of it. So, like, here's another feature of games, just to add to our catalog that we're coming up with. Games, you can play again, right?
Right.
Like, there's a chance to go back, you know?
Well, and I was going to say, there's an end where you've either won or you've lost. You die. When you die, you just lost the game, and then you get to start again. Or you win, you accomplish your goal.
Uh-huh.
And there's a victory condition in a game. You know, generally speaking, games aren't just, okay, we'll play for a while. Okay, now we stop.
Mm-hmm. So Ender has to play with the giant, the Dread Pirate Roberts game, where one is poisoned and one is not. And at this point he can't do it. And I mean, it's sort of interesting. I mean, it's well imagined, you know, on the first death, his figure, his avatar in the game would reappear on the giant's table to play again. On the second death, he'd go back to the landslides, then to the garden bridge, then to the mouse hole, you know, so he loses, it's not like you can save, it's not like you can save your game and always start back here. It's funny that there's sort of a cost to doing it, and that like the fact that he knows these things, and that like he knows what happens, you know, if you do it too many times, and like your iPad declares that free play time is over, sort of that indicates that he does it over and over and over again, returning and returning and returning and returning to this conundrum. And by the way, the game has sort of new gruesome ways to kill his avatar every time.
Right. You could actually imagine this game as a Flash game being relatively popular just because like people would want to be curious to see the different deaths each time.
Yeah. Right.
Because, you know, it's clearly you're not supposed to be able to win. So it's really all about, like, okay, well, how's this death going to go?
So he wins it.
Right.
Here. Oh, he gets into Fairyland.
Yeah, he wins the game that can't be won, which is the whole point of being Ender, is that supposedly he wins things that can't be won.
Right, right, right. And he... right, and he sort of takes his, and you get the sense that the giant takes umbrage at this by calling him a cheater, right? Mm-hmm. And then he goes up and pokes the giant's eye out. It's pretty gross, actually.
Yeah, it's pretty intense for
for a kid's book. But then, so what he says. You know, he hadn't meant to kill the giant. This was supposed to be a game, not a choice between his own grisly death and an even worse murder. Says, I'm a murderer even when I play. Peter would be proud of me. It's a terrible game. That's awful. That's, I mean, you know, right? Like, I wonder, like, do you imagine every child who's playing, you know, who's playing Modern Warfare 3, right? Like, do you imagine every child is, like, really, I don't know, puzzling over the moral implications of shooting all the non-player characters in the thing? But something about this, I mean, maybe something that we'll learn later. I mean, it seems to indicate that this is more serious.
Right. And what I think the game is meant to be empathetic. It's meant to get inside the kid's head. And of course we know that Ender is a very empathetic person, that if anybody's going to feel a game, it's going to be him.
Yeah, I guess. I mean, I guess if the game's trying to get inside of Ender's head, Ender's trying to get inside of the giant's head.
What?
And that's sort of where we leave it. I don't know. Do you have some observations that you would like to close out with?
Well, one thing I was saying, I think before we prepped, which is that, you know, this took us, you know, about an hour to get through, and there's a lot packed into these first six chapters.
Sure.
You know, I think it's about half of the hero's journey as far as accepting the call. He gets the call. He resists. He accepts the call. He
crossing the first threshold. Right. Yeah. Exactly. He's, even the like the elixir in the giant's bucket. Right. And then burrowing into the giant's eye, I think, is one of the lesser known steps along the
right
along the hero's journey. Yeah, it's very packed with sort of interesting moral questions as well. And that's actually one of the reasons that we're taking it, though you may not be able to, and you may, if you were like me, you read the whole book if you haven't read it before. I read it in two sittings, only because I absolutely had to go to sleep and work the next day. Otherwise, I would have just kept on straight through the night. It seems sort of sadistic of us to sort of parcel it out in these, in about a fifth of the book at a time, or even less. But it's, this is the pace that I think it will reward us to talk about it at. Because there's a lot, I think there's a lot to unpack.
Right. And I think it's interesting, the different sections of the book vary pretty widely tonally. And I don't mean that as a criticism. I think it handles the transitions pretty well. But the next 60 pages or so is a lot more about the interactions between Ender and his new armies and kind of more plotty details without so much of the characterizations and the philosophy and family dynamics. That just takes kind of a second stage for the next section to talk about some other stuff. And then there's a section that's primarily focused on the battle room, and it's kind of the tactics section of the book. And I think it's all well stitched together, but it's definitely behooves us to be breaking this up into chunks, because the different chunks are worthy of their own discussions.
So this time we sort of did a forced march through the plot in order. We don't have to do every week like that. And I think it will actually benefit us a lot if you care to start participating in the forums. And Ben and I can monitor the forums. We'll implant monitors in the... No, sorry, that's just gross. We'll keep watching the forums, and then the future audio podcasts can be more outgrowths of that discussion once we start having it, rather than just using the plot in each chapter for material. Though we'll certainly cover that and talk about what happens in the book. We hope that you will hop into the forums and get involved in the discussions. And there will be each week some discussion questions for you to start off. And yeah, please feel free to use those as a jumping off point, or to choose your own jumping off point and start a discussion topic based on something that you find particularly interesting and want to talk about. There will be a link to the appropriate forum section, because we're gonna break it out week by week in the show notes for this audio episode. So, well, thanks so much, Ben. This has been great getting into this.
Yeah, I'm excited to keep pushing. This was a good talk.
Yeah, me too. Excellent. Well, then we'll be back next week with more Ender's Game. Until then, you can visit us on the web at Overthinking It, where we subject the popular culture to a level of scrutiny
it probably
doesn't deserve.